Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. Since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. In this series, we'll be talking with experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who have been doing the hard work of fighting for a long time. They'll be sharing their insights on what works, what doesn't, what has changed, and what is still the same. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
My name is Mark Price. I'm a labor economist at the Keystone Research Center, which is based in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, so let's talk about just the basics on the budgeting process. Trump released his draft budget, which made everybody collectively scream because it was horrifying. But like what? Yeah, talk about that process a little bit.
Sure. So the president's obligation is to put forward a budget proposal. Typically, when administrations have put forward proposals, it's for the full scale of the actual budget, which includes non-defense discretionary spending, which is about a third. And then it also includes typically mandatory spending, priorities on Medicaid, Social Security, and food stamps, for instance, is in that category.
Right.
The president put forward a proposal for just the non-defense discretionary spending. So the sort of a small chunk, about a third of the budget, and what his spending priorities are in those areas. And obviously, I think a lot of people have reacted to that. Sort of, it's a laundry list of cuts in this discretionary spending that have long been sort of put forward by various groups over the last several decades. You know, the Reagan administration first proposed eliminating the Appalachian Regional Commission, and once again, it's sort of on his list of cuts.
Yeah.
And various folks have recommended things like cuts and, you know, reductions in LIHEAP, but where the president here is recommending eliminating the program entirely. So basically, the president puts forward his initial budget, and it's now falls to Congress to put forward health hearings in the various committees on the president's priorities and then form its own budget resolution. And I think that sort of points to where people can have an impact, because it's ultimately going to be the decisions that our congressional representatives and senators make in that next step of the budget process. They're going to be heavily influential in making sort of teasing out how much of the president's priorities in each of these areas end up becoming law. So the president has put forward his initial proposal. It's as the name of the budget implies, it's skinny and both with deep cuts to non-discretionary spending, but also, he sort of didn't do a big chunk of his job, which is essentially talking about the other parts of the budget. Perhaps those will be coming forward, but we have till April for Congress to step forward and put forward its own sort of budget resolution, its own priorities and spending in each of the areas that the president has proposed. And I think, you know, one of the things that I'm seeing, at least, there's a lot of energy. People are energized, particularly around healthcare. And so they're sort of trying to reach out to their representatives. You know, I live in a relatively small rural community, and people are showing up at town hall meetings and giving their representatives an earful. And I think on these various priorities, like, you know, heating assistance for low-income folks, Meals on Wheels,
right,
if people were to sort of show up at, town hall meetings to reach out to their members of Congress and let them know about, you know, that they care about these programs, that'll probably go a long way, probably more than in the past, because people are very energized, or at least they seem so.
Yeah.
And that would probably have a great effect, certainly more than in past years.
Yeah.
And also, I think it's important to recognize we don't have much of a safety net in the current environment we're in, right?
Right.
We have the Trump administration has set its priorities, and Congress is a Republican body at the moment,
right,
and sort of they have a lot of range of motion, and our ability to shape that really is going to come down to whether we can get individual members to think twice about cuts and programs that maybe make a lot of sense from, you know, perspective of ideology, but at the end of the day hurt a lot of their own voters. And I think that's really where the action is going to be, is if you can get people organized to sort of reach out to their representatives and shape that second step in the budget process.
I want to talk about some of these specifics, but also just in general, I think one of the things that's happening with Trump is that people are so thrown by him that they're paying attention to processes that they really normally don't. And so then what's happening is this sort of the this is not normal feeling is often not misplaced, but sort of...
it's not normal in the sense, how dare you recommend cuts to Meals on Wheels when, you know, it's not an unusual thing for folk to put forward, you know, maybe not that priority, but presidents have budget priorities, they put it forward. It's not the end of the conversation. Is that sort of what you're getting at?
Yeah, and also I would like to talk about some of this, the history of targeting some of these programs. As you said, Reagan wanted to make some of these same cuts and did make cuts in many of the programs that Trump is wanting to attack. And so, you know, he ran on sort of not being a typical Republican. And I would love for you to talk about the ways in which this budget shows that he very much is a typical Republican.
Certainly, it is really, at least the pieces of the budget that he's put forward that we are seeing definitely sort of fall into that broad group of Republican ideas about the government is too large, and so we need to reduce spending. And all of the spending reductions in discretionary spending, whether we're talking about, you know, heating assistance for seniors, you know, job training programs, you know, student aid for studies, range of benefits people all across the country, they're being cut, and almost all of the money is spent. It was sort of the, you know, it's a very typical approach in the sense that deep cuts to social programs, but not necessarily to go to deficit reduction, instead going to shifting to defense spending. And I think you folks in the conservative sort of frame usually want to see reductions in spending overall, but there is this big gorilla in the room called defense spending that seems, at least in Trump's vision, to be eating up most of that opportunity to reduce deficits. Although, again, there are other parts of the budget which we'll see going forward. In particular, you know, healthcare is, and speaking of gorillas in the room, right, as all of this is unfolding, you know, basically, it looks as though the effort on healthcare is really an effort to go after Medicaid, sort of, you know, taking advantage of the Affordable Care Act, you know, which was a step forward in terms of providing more coverage to people, but taking it as an opportunity not only to roll back the Affordable Care Act, but really undermine Medicaid, right? So it's sort of reducing the safety net in the other direction, sort of the opposite priorities of the Affordable Care Act. So I think absolutely it is typical in the sense that there are a lot of cuts proposed here that have been proposed in previous years to a wide range of programs. But they're all in one package, I guess is probably one aspect of this. And again, it's sort of very atypical of sort of the goal. You oppose heating assistance for the elderly because, you know, if they were cold, they'd go out and get a job and you know, have more money in order to pay for heat. You know, these are often strange priorities, but certainly that's sort of embodied here.
Yeah, and the comments from certain people about things like Meals on Wheels not showing any effectiveness. So you mentioned living in a rural area, and it has been noted in several places that the cuts in this budget would disproportionately affect rural voters who tend to be, or at least to be, governed by Republicans, if they are not themselves Republicans. And so talk about the way that in particular, you know, on one hand, it's you're kicking your voter base, but on the other hand, it also creates some leverage for those very people if their representatives want to continue to get reelected.
Absolutely. I think, you know, and this is sort of, for me, this is one thing I struggled a bit with. I think, you know, as time has passed after the election, there's been a lot of sort of hand-wringing about what happened and what was driving voters. And in particular, thinking about Appalachia, you know, there has been some discussion that, you know, there is a feeling in those communities that, you know, sort of a sense of pride in work in coal mines, for instance, right? And and a certain resentment towards government assistance, because it's seen as sort of the opposite of independence, right? You're dependent on the government. There is sort of, and mixed in with all of this, right, is this opioid addiction, right, which is sweeping across the country. And so I think on the one hand, you're absolutely right. This is a very real opportunity to get folks in these rural places energized, because they're going to be benefiting from a lot of these program cuts. Yeah. Whether it's the healthcare cuts that we are at least beginning to discuss, or some of these discretionary programs that Trump has put forward to be cut, certainly that's going to be an organizing point. But I think the challenge, as always with rural communities, is it's much harder. it's sort of a classic challenge in organizing unions. It's easier to organize a big workplace. Right. You've got lots of workers in one spot. You have people spread out in a lot of small communities, organizing, I think, becomes much harder. So that's an enormous challenge, which I can't help solve. But I think the fact that, a lot of these program cuts, whether it is heating assistance or Meals on Wheels, certainly it's going to create an opportunity to get a lot of these voters in these rural places to sort of wake up to what the policy priorities that are coming out of, certainly out of the president and the parts of the House and the Senate.
So when we talk about programs like the Appalachian Regional Commission, things like that, the budget will have this massive number of these programs that each one of them is not very much money, right? I've seen a lot of memes going around of one of Trump's golf trips could pay for Meals on Wheels. And so when thinking about fighting for them, it basically seems like people are going to seize on one or two of these, again, fairly small programs that are, obviously very important, but again, not very much in terms of the overall budget. And so I wonder if you have some advice for how best to sort of think about this as both an overall document and as a political statement and project. One of the things that happens here, right, is that like a couple of the programs that get put up to for cuts in this, like, catch the public attention. So like Meals on Wheels is the big one right now, even though as a portion of the budget, it's not very much money, right? And what's actually happening here is however many hundreds, thousands, I don't actually know, programs that add up to make up non-defense discretionary spending, right? I sort of worry that if everybody focuses on Meals on Wheels, that's $3 million. It's very easy for the Trump administration to go, fine, we'll save Meals on Wheels. And then you have billions of other cuts that are still killing people all over the place.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think clearly what a budget process for any president, not just the Trump presidency, but, for the Obama, Reagan, the initial budget proposals, they are sort of, they're testing the waters. These are our priorities. And certainly here, I think the Trump administration has put forward a broad range of cuts. And I suspect that they're not planning that all of those cuts will happen. They're sort of throwing as much mud on the wall as they possibly can to see what sticks. Yes. And I think you're absolutely right that which programs ultimately survive, it's sort of like, the cute animals are the ones that people are going to care about, or the animals that are easy to talk about and that communicate well. So Meals on Wheels, I think, the idea that cut will stick, I think is, as the last 10 days have made clear, that's not going to happen. That's a pretty embarrassing cut for any member of the House or the Senate to stand behind. So it's unlikely to hold. Appalachian Regional Commission, which makes investments in Appalachia, in economic development and workforce development in an effort to sort of energize and develop a region that has historically high levels of poverty and a lack of opportunity, that program might be harder to defend, right, in the sense that it doesn't communicate as well as Meals on Wheels or some of the other programs. So I think absolutely one dimension of this is going to be that not all of these cuts will be treated equally. Right. Some of them will be rolled back. I think it comes down to, again, how effective people are in organizing and letting their members in the Senate and the House know, that they do not support broadly these cuts. But I think you put your finger on a real challenge here, is that, a lot of the cuts that have been put forward here, there's a 20% cut to the Labor Department. And their work is vital and important when it goes into simple things like enforcing minimum wage law, making sure food safety and workplace safety are being properly enforced. Those cuts certainly are going to be real and have real and important impacts. They might be harder to communicate to people, and so they may stick more than other proposed cuts. So I think that is the real challenge, is how you push back. If you were in an environment where you had a goalie, in the sense that, you had a president, say the Obama administration, that could make sure, stand as a veto threat, that makes sure that certain things don't go through, you don't have that here. Essentially, it's a Republican president, Republican majorities in the Senate and the House. It's going to be very difficult to sort of contain the damage. And it's going to be hard to focus people on sort of the wide range of programs that have been cut. And I don't, unfortunately, back to your original question, I don't know how you deal with that other than, it just comes back to, making sure that representatives know beyond, your support for specific programs that you don't support these spending priorities overall. Making it clear that shifting $15 billion from these kind of sort of valuable programs that help a lot of different people across the country to defense spending, right, which is not terribly well specified, or it's not even clear, why we're doing this, I think is the best advice I can offer, which isn't very helpful. I mean, it is a real challenge here that it's going to be hard sometimes to communicate the dimensions, because it is, there's a wide variety of programs, from work study to, job training. These are things that are sort of abstract and difficult to talk about. That is a real challenge.
So defense spending, the old canard about defense spending is that, it's distributed in every congressperson's district, so nobody will ever vote to cut their own district. And I'm wondering almost how that same thing plays out here, where, again, we have not exclusively, but a lot of Republicans representing poor rural districts that are going to disproportionately face the pain of these cuts and not have local governments that can step in and mitigate some of that. The way that somebody who lives in New York City, whose members of Congress are obviously going to vote against any Trump budget anyway, but there is a New York City budget and government that can at least mitigate some of the harm that Trump can do, in the way that somebody who lives in rural Pennsylvania, where you are, or, in Maine, or in, Arkansas, doesn't have that same option. And so I'm wondering what things you're thinking, perhaps, that Republicans are already looking at and going, I'm going to get killed if I cut that.
That's a hard question for me to answer. I think it just depends a lot on the nature of the individual member of Congress. If you have an ideological member who's, deeply committed to the idea of shrinking government, whatever the size of government is, they're probably going to be somewhat impervious to various criticism. Whereas if you've got sort of run-of-the-mill members who do listen to their communities and do, who got elected because they know people in the local community and they're going to hear from them, I think there is certainly potential that for instance, we're talking probably too much about Appalachia, but, I think in Appalachia, there's probably going to be some hesitance on the part of a number of Republicans based on the institutions and the local communities that have benefited from Appalachian Regional Commission economic development programs in the past. There's going to be some sort of pushback that they're going to feel to defend that program because it has provided real benefits to local communities. And so I think, to the extent to which these various programs do land that way. I think, again, thinking about, you know, job training programs, you know, I think even housing assistance, you know, some of the block grants for economic development, those things are likely to be the most likely where there's going to be pressure, not simply from sort of voters, but where existing electeds and folks who are running community organizations are going to be pushing hard on those members.
Right.
To defend those priorities. I'm not good at identifying where all of those will be, but certainly I think there will be a broad pushback on a lot of these cuts in a lot of these places for Republicans especially.
And sort of to wrap up, because again, we're sort of having this conversation because I think a lot of people are just now trying to figure out how processes like this work. What would you suggest for things people can read and ways that people who have not followed basically the workings of Congress and the budgeting process and the way these things happen closely? Where would you recommend people look to learn about how these things work?
Sure. I think, you know, one good place to start is the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which is a D.C. think tank that spends much of its time worrying about non-defense discretionary spending, this sort of the totally non-organizable term, but the things that capture, you know, investments in communities and in low-income housing assistance, food stamps, all of those. The center puts together little primers, and one of their primers is on the budget process, the federal budget process, where it goes through and explains each step of the budget process and also gives folks some numbers and puts those numbers in the proper context. Here's how much, you know, discretionary spending represents of total federal spending. That's a good place, I think, to start to sort of get a basic understanding of the budget process in D.C. that we're going through. And I think that's probably the best place to start.
And so finally, how can people keep up with you?
How can they keep up with me? They can find me on the web at www.keystoneresearch.org. And there they'll see my research and the advocacy that I do. On Twitter, you can follow me at @price_laborecon.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Fayebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.